Paramount Broadcast Center, this is Take Two, me, Martinez. Once there was a dream for a high-speed train from L.A. to the Bay, and while the plan hasn't gone completely off the rails, some of the billions allocated to the project could shift tracks to local train lines. Plus, how some illegal guns end up in California.
I have done observational work at gun shows in Nevada and Arizona and found that a third of the cars in the parking lot are from California.
Next on Take Two.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is August 5th. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Hope your week's going smooth so far. Today on the program, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a new law that would require presidential candidates to submit their tax returns to get on the state's primary ballot, but Republicans are calling foul. We'll discuss whether it could end up in court. Plus, we check in on the status of a project devoted to LA's Black experience after Metro announces a $15 million infusion.
We hope that we can do to Crenshaw today what was done to Harlem in the 1920s.
Our conversation about Destination Crenshaw is coming up toward the end of the show, so stay tuned. First, though, the path to a high-speed rail connecting Southern and Northern California has not exactly been smooth. The multi-billion-dollar project began in 2008, but has since faced a ballooning price tag and also a dwindling funding source, not to mention the problem of dealing with lawsuit after lawsuit in its construction. Now, hoping to salvage what they could, the LA Times reports today that some California lawmakers have come up with a plan to redirect the money earmarked for high-speed rail. Instead, those dollars would be invested in local transportation projects in San Francisco and right here in Los Angeles. One potential project would directly benefit the people of Glendale and Burbank. And to tell us how, we have Laura Friedman, Democratic State Representative from Glendale. Welcome to Take Two.
Happy to be here. Thanks for your interest.
Sure. Now, okay, this plan is in the very early stages, nothing set in stone. But if money were redirected, what might the people in your area eventually see on the roads and rails? Because I live in Burbank. I often have to wait for trains near the airport. So I want to know what I'd be looking at if the money heads Burbank's way.
Thanks. And I think that this is a real regional project, not just for the people of Glendale and Burbank, but for all of Los Angeles. What this shift in funding would do, it would be to shift approximately $5 billion into the Bay Area and into Southern California. And what could be done is in a relatively short period of time, we could do the grade separations necessary on the Metrolink tracks to ensure that we can get trains going from the Burbank Airport all the way to Anaheim much more quickly than they do now, and get the trains running to where you could have a 15-minute time between each train, which would bring millions of additional riders per year into the train system because it would run much more frequently, be much faster, and a much more attractive alternative for people who might be driving along that route. In addition, the funds could electrify all of the trains in that area so that you could get the benefits of clean air from an electrified train fleet.
So just in a nutshell, I might see more trains, but I wouldn't necessarily be stopping if I'm driving through because it would look different in terms of how the trains would go on the track.
Right. They wouldn't be going across roads that have traffic on them. They wouldn't have the problem with signalization and potential accidents with cars getting stalled on train tracks. They would be completely grade separated, so they'd be free of the vehicular traffic. And in addition, we need to make sure that we fix Union Station so that we don't continue to have a main train hub where trains have to pull in and then literally back out to get out. That causes an incredible amount of delay along the system, whereas if the trains would be able to just go in and then continue on their path and continue going north and south, we would again have a much more efficient and faster moving system.
Who would this benefit? Because on the face of it, it sounds like it benefits tourists maybe heading to, say, Disneyland or the Anaheim Convention Center.
Well, it benefits everyone. I have a mother who lives part of the year in Laguna Beach, and I take Metrolink there constantly in the winter. And it takes a while sometimes, particularly going through that Union Station area, because the trains go in and have to wait sometimes 15 minutes to get back out again. So for people like me that want to not have to be in traffic for 2 hours in each direction, it benefits them. And I might say that the Amtrak line that goes from San Diego along these same tracks up to continuing north is one of the most heavily traveled Amtrak lines in the entire country. So there is a strong desire for efficient rail in the system. So it benefits commuters. people who are going to be commuting from any of those locations to downtown or to any of those points along that route. Benefits people, like you said, tourists going to Disneyland and going to the Burbank, anyone who wants to go to the Burbank Airport. But it benefits anyone who's on the road, because anytime you take cars off the road, you have better air quality, you have less traffic congestion, you're giving people more alternatives to get around. And what we really need in Southern California, what we really need in Los Angeles, is an efficient rail system. I'm speaking to you right now from Williamsburg, Brooklyn. I've been in trains all week in Boston and in New York City, and I've had no desire to be in a car. I've been moving quickly across vast areas. It's been pleasant. I've got my six-year-old with me, and she loves being on the train and not being tied down in the back of a car. It's a better quality of life for everybody.
And when you mention people not being in cars, for the ones that have to be in cars, they won't be idling as much, sitting there waiting for the train to go by.
Well, they certainly are not going to be idling at all, waiting for trains to go by, because those trains will be grade separated from them, and there'll be hopefully a lot less traffic on the road as we build out our public transportation infrastructure.
We're talking to Democratic State Representative Laura Friedman from Glendale. Now, when the people of California signed on to the idea of a high-speed rail, they thought the money was going to go to that specific project. So what do you say to people who still want that, who still want that high-speed rail from San Francisco all the way to Los Angeles, and might call this move a bait and switch?
Well, right now, the current proposal is not technically to do that in any upcoming period of time. The proposal now is to do high-speed rail from Merced to Bakersfield, and I'm saying you should still do that. But what we're arguing is you don't need to electrify that, number one. And number two, you save billions of dollars from not going into downtown Bakersfield, from instead going just a little bit further out and stopping still in Bakersfield, but not having to do all of the eminent domain and all of the work to get into downtown Bakersfield. And the reason it's important that we put money where it's necessary is because we have such a drastic need for public transportation and efficient public transportation in our urban hubs, much more than we do in the Central Valley. And if we get people out of their cars, we will really be taking emissions out of our air and improving air quality. And we get more people out of our cars by improving rail in our urban centers. There's no doubt about that. And once we prove that people are willing to get into trains, that's when we can make the better argument for extending that high-speed rail system all the way to San Diego. Right now, it doesn't seem to make sense for a lot of people because they're not seeing their train ridership to show the demand. But if we get to 15-minute train durations in Los Angeles, if we get to trains that move with a much faster through the urban core because of the grade separations, and we can get people onto those trains through those efficiencies, because it'll take so much less time now to get to Anaheim, to get to the Burbank Airport, that's when we demonstrate proof of concept, and that's where we get the public will for the high-speed rail extension.
One last thing before you go. How do you plan to get over the legal and political problems that may arise from trying to redirect the money? And briefly, just we only got a few seconds left.
Sure. I don't think that there's legal stipulations, because we're still continuing the project and the money would still be going into rail, but I'm not a lawyer. And in terms of politics, from what I hear from people is they want that money directed where they know it's going to help improve quality of life for residents of California. And I think a lot of people are dubious about the Merced Bakersfield really giving the kind of return that the investment's going to warrant. Whereas if you say we're going to put $5 billion into the Bay Area and into Los Angeles to have projects be completed within 10 years, 10 years is not a lot of time. People say that's money better spent.
Laura Friedman, Democratic State Representative from Glendale. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are a lot of unanswered questions after a gunman opened fire at the Gilroy Garlic Festival Sunday, killing 3, injuring 15. While lawmakers search for a motive, others wonder how yet another shooting can happen here in California, the state with some of the country's toughest gun laws. We're going to get some answers from Garen Wintemute. He directs the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis. Welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Researchers at Boston University have counted 107 gun-related laws in California. By the numbers, Garen, do gun laws make us safer here?
That's an overly simplistic question, but the overly simplistic answer is yes. California has a robust regulatory regime. Not by coincidence, we have lower than average rates of firearm homicide and suicide, and our rates have been trending down while those for the rest of the country have been trending up.
And when it comes to safety, how does California compare to states with fewer gun laws?
Well, there are two differences. One is that we have enacted policies that keep high-risk people from purchasing firearms. That's a good thing. The other is quite simply that we have a much lower prevalence of firearm ownership than other states do. And one very firmly established finding, not surprisingly, is that the higher the prevalence of ownership, the more bad things happen.
Is it reasonable to make the connection that since it's a little harder to get a gun in California, that maybe sometimes people will say, well, maybe I want one, but I got to cut through all that red tape to get one.
Absolutely. And one of the things they do is go to Nevada.
And we're going to talk about that in just a couple of minutes. But which laws would you say have kept California the safest in your view?
I'll name just two. There are many. One is that we require a background check on all purchases of firearms, whether that purchase is made from a licensed retailer or from a private party. The other is that we have expanded on the denial criteria, the prohibition criteria that are in force under federal law. For example, we prohibit people who've been convicted of misdemeanor violent crimes, including but not only domestic violence, from buying guns. In much of the country, you can have a record of violent crime that's as long as your arm, but as long as those crimes are not felonies or domestic violence, you can buy all the guns you want.
We're talking to Garen Wintemute. He directs the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis. Now, according to the Giffords Law Center, California ranks 44th in the nation when it comes to gun deaths, and that puts the state in the bottom six. And yet, almost all of us can recount at least three deadly mass shootings in the past 4 years. 2015, San Bernardino, Thousand Oaks, that was in November, and now the one on Sunday. And in that one, the one on Sunday in Gilroy, the gun was purchased in another state. Are out-of-state guns common in shootings in California?
We don't have data on shootings specifically. We do know that about a third of guns used in crime in California were first purchased in some other state and then obviously were brought to California. They may have entered legal commerce in California and have been bought and sold legally in California before being used in a crime.
Now, California Governor Gavin Newsom has responded to the news that the gun used in Sunday's attack was bought in Nevada. Here's a clip of that.
You know, I can't put borders up, speaking of borders, in a neighboring state where you can buy this damn stuff legally. How the hell is that possible?
Garen, are we really powerless to stop guns, especially assault-style weapons, from entering the state?
No, we are not. And I think this is really important. I have done observational work at gun shows in Nevada and Arizona, just to pick one example, and found that a third of the cars in the parking lot are from California. So just to give you a rough estimate, it is well known that people go to gun shows or gun stores in Nevada and bring those weapons back to California because they can't get them here or they can't get them without leaving a paper trail. This is well enough known that there is a law enforcement effort. I'm not allowed to talk about the details, but it is specifically set up in order to intercept those people as they cross the border.
I realize you just said that you're not allowed to talk about it in too much detail, but how would that work? Would police be set up at gun shows in the parking lot, seeing where people come out of these Nevada gun shows and into California licensed cars?
They're in the shows, and they see the transaction occur and might follow the person to the parking lot and see what license plate is on the car. And if that car appears to be headed for California, and if there's a determination that what was just bought at the show is probably illegal, contact is made and that trip doesn't get completed.
But if a gun is bought legally in another state, what would the recourse be at that point, even if they bring it somewhere else?
Let's talk about this particular instance. So under Nevada law, that purchase may have been legal. Under California law, it was not. He was too young. The weapon was prohibited. And California law does not allow you to purchase guns out of state and bring them back in without declaring them and filing the paperwork. Now, here's the key that has not been talked about much. Under federal law, applying in both California and Nevada, a purchase is only legal if it's legal not only in the state where it occurred, but in the state where the person resides. And if this young man did not have a Nevada residence established, if he bought that gun as a California resident, that purchase may have been illegal under federal law. I don't think we're done with this.
Now, I know Senator Elizabeth Warren has mentioned this, but do we need to study gun violence more closely, do more research on this?
You're asking that question of a researcher, so you can't see me smiling. Of course we do. But I'm also a clinician. I'm involved in prevention. And from both points of view, I can tell you that there's no part of this problem about which we know enough. We don't know enough about who's at risk. We don't know nearly enough about the consequences. I mean, who's going to track all these people who are exposed in Gilroy and see what has happened to the course of their lives, the lives of their family members as a result of what happened a few days ago? We don't know nearly enough about which interventions are most effective, which is what we're all very concerned about.
For people who might be looking at shootings like the one we saw on Sunday and thinking, wow, even our own laws in our own state don't protect us. Based on what you know, is there any comfort for people who maybe are a little worried right now?
I think everybody's worried. And if I can make a broader point, public mass shootings are changing the character of American public life and not for the better. We need to come to terms with that. Specific example, lots of little county fairs are going to be in operation between now and Labor Day. And I suspect everyone who goes is going to think just for a moment, do I really want to go? What's my escape plan? Do I want to take my kids? There was a time when we didn't think that way. By way of kind of reassurance, I can point out that while we have these events in California, many more than we would like, we're a big state, and our rate of these events is really quite low. Let me make a second point that will not be reassuring. Public mass shootings are actually rare events. They account for less than 1% of people who die from firearm violence. They don't even account for most mass shootings. Most mass shootings are not public events. For me as a researcher, for me as a clinician, I am well aware that we need to pay attention to the much larger problem, the 99%, the community violence, the daily homicide in cities, suicides about which we don't even have a public story.
Garen Wintemute directs the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis. Garen, thanks a lot.
A pleasure.
Some of our neighbors in LA do not have a tangible place to call home, so they make do wherever they can, and that usually means everything they own in the world is always with them, which then runs the risk of losing it all when cities go on cleanup sweeps. Imagine no ID, no family pictures, nothing, just the clothes you have on. Coming up next, the story of a person who lost all their stuff just minutes after a visit from a high-profile politician. That's ahead when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by August 5th for up to $8,000 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. An estimated 3.1 million Americans could be at risk of losing food stamp benefits under a new proposal by the Trump administration. The rule would tighten eligibility requirements for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says this would close a loophole that allows people receiving minimal benefits from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program to be automatically eligible for SNAP. Here to break down what this could all mean for the Golden State's CalFresh program is Jackie Botts, reporter with Cal Matters, who covers income inequality in California. Jackie, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Okay, now, before we dig into the new proposal, what are the current eligibility requirements for the food stamp program?
Yeah, so in California right now, families have to have a total income of less than 200% of the federal poverty line to qualify to get CalFresh, which is what we call the program here in California, as long as their expenses that include shelter, medical costs, child care, bring their net income down to below 100% of the federal poverty line.
Okay, so then from that, what would change under the proposed rule?
Right. So the rule essentially realigns all of the states with the federal rules for who gets food stamps. So the federal rules say that to get food stamps, your household can't make more than 130% of the federal poverty line. And you also can't have savings or assets over a certain limit, which is $2,250 for most cases. So right now, 40 states, including California, have lifted those income or asset limits to account for the fact that people in their states can't always get by on that income, even with some extra help from food stamps. And this proposal would undo that and bring all of the states back to a limit of 130% of the federal poverty line.
So basically a one-size-fits-all states kind of rule.
That's exactly right.
Now, would savings or assets be included in net income?
No, it's a separate test. So your net income is one test, and that has to be less than 100% of the federal poverty line. And then your assets or savings is a separate test, and that has to be below $2,250, like I said, for most families.
Now, considering, Jackie, that California is different from other states, I mean, we all have differences, all the states have differences, what kind of effect could this have on people right here?
Right. So we have a lot of people in California, especially working families with kids or with disabled family members who fall into that upper margin of being eligible for CalFresh, but who would get cut under this proposal. And the reason is that low-income workers in California tend to have higher incomes than low-income workers in the rest of the country, because our lawmakers have lifted the minimum wage to try to keep up with the high cost of housing and other basic expenses here.
So just because it costs more to live here, because it just costs more to live here in California, and employers have tried to meet that as well, that won't be taken account under these new rules?
Right, exactly. So there are many states that have a minimum wage right now that is the federal minimum wage of $7.25. But compare that to California, where our minimum wage is $12 per hour. And by 2023, it will be $15 per hour for all workers.
Talking to Cal Matters reporter Jackie Botts. Now, you've been reporting on the challenges some CalFresh recipients face. Can you tell us how they feel this rule might impact them?
Yeah, absolutely. So I spoke with a woman named Antoinette Martinez. She is a single mom who is a CalFresh recipient herself. And she also works at her local food bank in Santa Cruz County, where she helps other people sign up for CalFresh as well. So she knows CalFresh firsthand, and she also sees how it affects other people. And, you know, for her family, her budget's pretty tight. We're with her while she went grocery shopping. And she says that if she didn't get CalFresh, it would get tighter. But she also said that as someone who herself is studying to be a case manager and works with people to get CalFresh, she's really worried about what this would mean in Santa Cruz County, where she sees a lot of homelessness and a lot of people who are struggling with poverty at the same time that they're struggling with other things like addiction or mental illness.
You went shopping with her, you said. Did she mention of the stuff that she bought when she was with you, how much of that wouldn't be in her shopping cart?
No, she didn't tell me that. But she seemed to think that she and her son would be able to make ends meet if they stopped getting CalFresh. She said they would find a way.
Now, right now, this is all still just a proposal, and there's a 60-day comment period before a final decision is made. So should food stamp recipients be worried quite yet?
That's a good question. So there is the 60-day public comment period, and then at that point, the federal government will be looking at all of the public comments and then deciding what's next. At this point, we actually have several pending proposals that are sort of similar to this one in that they would curtail public benefits for some Americans that have gone through this whole period of a 60-day public comment period and still haven't been put into effect. So they're hanging right now, and we don't know what would happen after the 60-day public comment period for this rule either.
What's the likelihood of this White House proposal actually happening?
You know, that's a really good question that I asked a lot of my sources, and I couldn't answer it definitively myself, but I did speak to anti-poverty advocates who say that they think that it's quite likely that all of these rules will be put into effect before the 2020 election. One advocate suspected that they would all be put into effect on the same day.
That's CalMatters reporter Jackie Botts, who's been following the story. Jackie, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Now, Jackie's also been reporting on the challenges people face enrolling in CalFresh, the state's SNAP program, and has been circulating a questionnaire asking people to share their experience. You can find a link to that on our website, scpr.org/take2. Out of those struggling to find shelter, LA's spending a lot of money to try and get these people off the streets and into a more permanent place to live. But sometimes it seems like the city is working against itself, especially when it comes to how it cleans up homeless encampments. Sometimes those the city intends to help get hurt.
Everything was in there. My husband's tools.
Matt Tinoco has a story of how one woman lost all of her belongings just minutes after a visit from LA Mayor Eric Garcetti.
Rochelle is about 5'5", blonde, middle-aged, and she has the weathered skin of somebody who lives outside. She was in foster homes as a kid, like about 15% of LA County's homeless.
When I was 19, I was aged out with a $200 check. Bye, good luck, have fun, with no ID, no nothing.
These days, home is a dirt embankment between a plant nursery and a busy street in North Hollywood. About a dozen makeshift shelters and tents line the block. I met Rochelle during a visit to her encampment with LA Mayor Eric Garcetti.
What's up, brother?
What's up, man? You good?
The mayor came out to see firsthand conditions on the street and to talk to neighboring businesses. See, the city gets thousands of complaints each month from business owners and residents who want the encampments gone. But how LA deals with those complaints? Well, it can work against other efforts to get people off the street. Garcetti starts his visit with a round of handshakes.
I've seen you on TV.
Yeah, TV agent.
Caseworkers with the mayor give one woman a temporary motel voucher and get her assessed for further assistance.
One of the things that's kind of magical is, as mayor, sometimes I can make the difference of whether somebody will say today's the day that I'll actually come off the streets.
Well, today is not the day for Rochelle.
Nice to meet you. Bye, guys.
We head to another location, but I come back to this spot later. 20 minutes after I arrive, a white garbage truck pulls up to the encampment. Two city workers throw a couple of shopping carts into the truck. To my eye, the carts are clearly packed with somebody's belongings. This happens right where the mayor was promising help for the homeless. I run over to talk to the workers.
What just happened? The carts?
Yeah, legal dump, I guess. That got reported.
When did they call you?
About like 45 minutes ago.
This was just after noon, which means they would have gotten that call less than half an hour after the mayor left. It turns out the dump they hauled off was all of Chriselle's possessions.
Everything I own is gone again.
Chriselle tells me she'd packed up the carts to take with her to the laundromat.
No ID, no nothing, no medicine, no nothing. It was all in there.
Cell phones, food.
My kids' pictures, everything I own, like my clothes. I have only the clothes on my back now.
Ask any homeless person in the city of Los Angeles, and they'll probably say something similar has happened to them. Multiple times, even. Although city rules say confiscated property is supposed to be stored and made available for pickup. On the day Chrishell lost everything she owns, LA was scheduled to do more than 50 encampment cleanups. Yes, the tent cities are a health and safety nightmare. But do the cleanups work? Even LA County's top homeless officials say no. An encampment swept away one day often just comes back the next. Plus, it can undo any progress people in the encampments may have made to get housed. Like Chrishell. She lost her ID, plus contact information for the outreach workers who came along with the mayor. The ones we pay to get people off the street.
How are we supposed to better ourselves? I have no, like, I'm optionless.
I wanted to know who called for the truck that took Chrishell's belongings. When I first asked the mayor's office, they said they didn't call. So I asked the Bureau of Sanitation, and they told me they had no record of the pickup. The second time I called the mayor's office, they acknowledged that, oh, actually, someone with the mayor that day did call. About some empty shopping carts. Except they weren't empty. And now Chrishell is a few steps farther away from housing. Covering homelessness, I'm Matt Tinoco.
And one more note, the mayor's press secretary sent KPCC a follow-up statement saying the carts were removed because they were blocking a parking lot and they deeply regret the loss of personal property. In related news, the LA City Council today voted to reinstate a temporary ordinance that prohibits people from sleeping in their vehicles on residential streets or within 500 feet of a school or park between the hours of 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. The ordinance mandating this was instated in 2017, but had recently lapsed. This vote extends the ban for 6 months. Critics have called it cruel because unhoused people living in LA sometimes do not have a lot of options. The motion was passed today by the council without comment. Tomorrow in the show, we'll discuss in more detail what effect this ordinance has had on the community. All right, got any plans to run for president or governor of California? If you do and want your name to appear on Golden State ballots, there's one key piece of information you got to show everyone before that can happen. And it has to do with stuff you've been claiming over the last few years. Find out what you got to reveal when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. This morning, Governor Gavin Newsom signed into law Senate Bill 27, otherwise known as the Presidential Tax Transparency and Accountability Act. It's an unprecedented mandate that requires presidential and gubernatorial candidates to provide 5 years of income tax filings in order to appear on the state primary ballot. The law takes effect today, and it's already stirring up controversy and could lead to a court fight. John Myers has been writing about this. He's the Los Angeles Times Sacramento Bureau Chief. He's on the line now. John, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
All right. Every step of the way, this bill has drawn criticism from Republican lawmakers who say this is just a law targeted at one person, and that's the guy that lives in the White House. He is not specifically named in this law, but do they have a point?
Sure, they've got a point. I think the inspiration absolutely was President Trump. The authors of the bill in the legislature would tell you that. They tried in 2017. Governor Jerry Brown vetoed it. They got a new governor this year, and they got it to his desk. And as you said, Governor Newsom signed it today. I mean, it's important to point out that it would apply to all candidates. It's not just a Trump bill. Anybody that's the Democrats running for president would have to agree to this as well. It also applies to candidates for California governor. That was an addition to this that was added in the 2019 version. But really, this is going to end up in the courts. Everybody knows that the courts have to decide whether a state can require a presidential candidate to put those tax returns out there to get on the primary ballot. And we're going to find out. All sides are prepared for a legal battle.
What has Governor Newsom said in defense of the bill and why it's necessary?
I mean, in short, the signing message we got today was that accountability matters, transparency matters, the same things that the authors had said that we need to know, voters need to know if there are any conflicts of interest that a president has with national or foreign interests. And, you know, again, you can read the Trump subtext into this, the criticisms of President Trump. But he's been very critical over the last few years about the president's refusal to release his tax returns. Governor Newsom did release his tax returns during the 2018 campaign, and so he certainly would have qualified. It is kind of interesting, A, that I will point out that Governor Brown did not release his in the 2010 and 2014 campaigns, and his veto, which was, you know, saying I don't think this is constitutional, certainly was in contrast to the way that Governor Newsom has approached this. And, you know, the early reaction from Washington, from the Trump campaign, from Republicans is, we'll see you in court, it's unconstitutional, and like I said, on we go.
Yeah, so that's what you got a statement, actually, from the president's reelection campaign, right?
Yeah. They basically said, you know, not only is there an unconstitutional thing going on here, states can't do this, but also where does this end? And that's something that Governor Brown said. I think they're echoing Governor Brown's veto message from 2017. Where does it end? Is it high school records? Is it college records? Is it health care documents to get on the ballot? You know, where is the end to this? And I will point out that, you know, some have said, Republicans control the legislatures in other states. Might those Republican legislatures say, great, then let's have a standard here that might embarrass a Democratic candidate? This is going to be a fascinating discussion, I think, in the courts and also in the court of public opinion about the role of states in choosing presidents. It is different than other offices, it looks like. I mean, certainly the litmus test for congressional candidates and presidential candidates is somewhat different. But we're going to find out a lot here. And I think, you know, key to this, of course, was, you know, Donald Trump didn't think he needed California anyway and wasn't going to have a lot of Californians voting for him. You know, does this significantly change things for him? Or more importantly, does it change it for Republican candidates for the legislature and Congress who need that person on the top of the ticket to help drive voter support to the polls? All of this kind of swirls around these first few hours. A lot of national attention, California first state to do this.
Senator John Myers, Los Angeles Times, Sacramento Bureau Chief. One of the things in that statement from the president's reelection campaign director that to me jumped out is that they're claiming that it violates the First Amendment. What argument are they making there?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't quite defend it for them. But I suppose that, you know, that the president has a right to say what he wants to say about his finances. I suppose that's the argument there. But I mean, you know, this has been teed up for quite some time. They've known that this was coming down the train. They knew that California was coming for them. They knew Newsom's statements suggested that he was going to be different on this than Brown had been. And we should point out, 18 states have looked at this for requiring tax returns being released to get on to the ballot. California is just the first one that actually has put it into law. And this law takes effect today. It has an urgency clause to it. So it is effective as of today, as of time we're speaking. And so I think that really accelerates this challenge about getting to the courts before you get into the primary season, which, of course, we know is in early March of next year here in California.
How did the bill's author, State Senator Mike McGuire, respond?
He's obviously pleased. I talked to him early this morning and he said, you know, this is the release of tax returns to quote him, is a low bar for a presidential candidate. It's the very least we can do. And he fell back on the familiar argument that we have a 40-year tradition in America of presidential candidates and presidents releasing their tax returns. Only President Trump and President Ford in 1976 in that time period did not release their tax returns in some way. And he said, you know, this is about a principle, you know, of democracy, of the voters have a right to know. And it's bigger than Donald Trump. He said it's not all about him, even though, of course, it was inspired clearly by the president.
So two very partisan ways to look at it. I mean, we're going to be in court on this, right? I mean, that's where it's going.
Yeah. Everybody believes it. It's just a matter of time. And I do think, A, you're going to see this happen sooner rather than later, simply because it is law today. And the election calendar, the clock starts to tick here about figuring out all of this by within, honestly, by November in California of ballot access. So we're going to see something pretty soon, I think.
Now, John, you mentioned you're not a lawyer, but I'm wondering if this could be seen as an overstep of power, or is the governor maybe on solid ground here?
Again, your guess is as good as mine.
People are taking the bar exam in California right now, so I always thought maybe you slipped in there. And
I will. I mean, I do think it's interesting, though, that when Newsom signed this today and he put out a video online as well, he invoked the fact that the rules or the norms, I guess I should say, the norms of presidential campaigns have changed through the years. He talked about how George Washington only served one term and how Roosevelt, after four terms, people said, no, we can't have four terms, and that the norms of governing and presidential politics have changed. And he suggested that the norms now need to change yet again. Whether he can force that through or, you know, the courts will agree with him is another matter. But clearly, it's an interesting discussion point, and I do think it's going to raise additional questions about what else should we demand of those who seek office to be transparent and clear with the voters about who they are and where they stand.
All right. One more thing. We've heard all the responses from different people on this. Where do you see this going right off the bat?
First and foremost, I think we're going to hear about it on the campaign trail. I will be fascinated to see whether we hear it at the Democratic presidential debates over the next two nights, about because not all of those candidates have released their tax returns, I should point out. And then, you know, the president is quite good at Twitter, and I will be expecting to see what he says about California here, too. And also, I really want to point out before we wrap up that, you know, California and Donald Trump have a complicated relationship. I mean, Newsom criticizes him and Democrats criticize him, but the president's administration has been very key on disaster relief for wildfires and for the earthquake. And, you know, this is another complicated part of that story between Donald Trump and California, and we'll see where it goes, I think, in the courts very soon.
John Myers, LA Times, Sacramento Bureau Chief. John, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
A lot of metro stops in L.A. have unique features. For example, Hollywood and Vine on the Red Line has all those film reels on the roof. Metro is committing a few million bucks to do exactly that at a station soon to be built. Find out where when Take Two continues. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. Destination Crenshaw, an outdoor museum that aims to celebrate the people and culture of South L.A., was recently awarded a $15 million by Metro last week. A 1.3-mile project is going to be built along the upcoming Crenshaw LAX line between 48th and 60th Streets. It's a project that L.A. Councilmember Marquise Harris-Dawson has been heavily involved with. He represents District 8. That's where the project would be located. Councilmember, welcome back to Take Two.
It's good to be here.
Okay, let's start with the beginning of the project itself. When and why did this idea of an open-air museum come to life?
This idea came to life after a series of community meetings with residents, businesses, and other folks concerned about the impact of the Metro Rail investment along Crenshaw Boulevard. There's a history of disruption in communities when transit investments are made, and so folks really wanted to make sure that this transit investment, which we welcome, was an opportunity for South LA to solidify the community rather than one that would transform it.
What were people worried that might go there?
The big worry is the one of gentrification. So housing that is now at an affordable level for working class and even poor people, if suddenly that area became accessible by rail to the beach and to downtown and Century City within 30 minutes, those rents would go up dramatically, and literally the face, texture, and culture of the community would change. And folks came up with the idea of Destination Crenshaw as a way of solidifying, branding, and hopefully continuing the community as it exists today.
Now, some initial design renderings of the projects were released late last year. We have that on our website, take2.org. But describe the vision for us. So say I'm walking along Crenshaw Boulevard, what would I be seeing?
Along Crenshaw, you'll see street signs, you'll see street furnitures. There will be over a half dozen pocket parks
There will be public art. There will be art on private buildings that will, again, celebrate the story of people in South L.A., specifically African Americans, but also demonstrate the art renaissance that's happening within Los Angeles and particularly within the African American community in Los Angeles.
Talking to L.A. City Councilmember Marquise Harris-Dawson about Destination Crenshaw, what do you hope that this will do for the community? What kind of impact do you think it could have?
We hope that we can do to Crenshaw today what was done to Harlem in the 1920s, so that if you drop me off in Harlem, the history, the culture is there. You get a sense of the story. You get a sense of the people. And despite what's happened to a lot of Manhattan, Harlem is held as a center for African-American life and culture. And we think you do that by leading with culture.
Councilmember, I can imagine there's going to be a lot of artists, a lot of people that want to contribute to this in some way, to contribute their experience and their vision for what it should be. How do you parse through all that and find the ones that are going to ultimately make this thing happen?
For starters, there will be over 100 art opportunities that Destination Crenshaw itself will provide. It's our expectation that beyond that, private property owners and institution will provide additional art opportunities. And so we will have, you know, competitions and ask folks to put forward proposals like you would in any situation. And we trust that there are going to be enough opportunities for everybody. And we're going to blaze this place up with art. You know, every electrical box will have art. Every bus bench will have art. Every street light will have some art.
Looking at the project's website, it says Destination Crenshaw will be built for, by, and in honor of our community. So I'm wondering what kind of decisions are going to be made in terms of bringing in the community to make sure that they're part of this process.
Well, Destination Crenshaw also already has a community advisory board that consists of residents, business owners, artists, and other folks interested in the community. And so they're kind of making the decisions about, you know, sort of where things go, what artists we look forward to be a part of the process. And that'll continue as the project goes on. And then, of course, once you build something like this, you can't just build it and walk away. We need people to be friends of Destination Crenshaw, and we expect to build that over the long term so that, again, that Destination Crenshaw is not only built by us and for us, but it is maintained by us and for us.
Now, anything built, council member, gets paid for. So how much is all of this expected to cost, and who's going to pay for it?
Well, the project is about a $100 million project. We're about halfway there on fundraising, and you saw the big announcement from Metro. As a part of their investment in rail, they're making a $15 million commitment to the project. The state of California has made a $10 million commitment to the project. And we're getting help from large foundations in California, the Weingart Foundation being one of the more notable ones, and also individuals in the city, you know, Erica Glazer, the movie director J.J. Abrams, and Katie McGrath, and a host of others continue to contribute and have contributed.
The Metro money, Councilmember, was that money that was already going to be spent on that area to begin with?
Yes. So my understanding is that there are resources for rail enhancements, and Destination Crenshaw presented robust programming for Metro to invest in and complements the station there at Leimert Park as well as the Crenshaw line writ large.
All right, so when is this going to get built, and when will it open?
Well, we expect to open with the train, and right now the date on the train is a moving target, but I would expect by the end of 2020 we would have a firm date in sight within several weeks.
That's Councilmember Marquise Harris-Dawson spearheading Destination Crenshaw. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
All right, in closing today, the California State Parks announced that 26 local projects throughout the state will receive grants totaling $4.1 million from the California Habitat Conservation Fund Grant Program. This program provides assistance to local agencies for the protection, restoration, and enhancement of wildlife habitat, and several parks right here in Southern California will benefit from it. In LA County, they include the Peck Road Park Wildlife Area and the Prime Desert Woodland Preserve Trail in Lancaster. In Orange County, the Craig Regional Park Lake Restoration Project will get about $194,000 to restore approximately 3 acres of wetlands. And in Riverside County, the Desert Recreation District will be given about $90,000 to provide an outdoor environmental program for disadvantaged youth in the Coachella Valley. So there you have it. Some good things happening outdoors, so enjoy it. And while you're outdoors, why don't you listen to Take Two? You can find us on the app, on the KPCC app, or wherever you find your podcast. Just look for the Take Two show. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at @AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.